If I had to list the 10 best days I've spent in the White House, Thursday, May 21st, would certainly be among them. This was my trip to Kentucky. Up early and out to the airport to catch the chartered conveyor at 7 o'clock, with Liz, of course, and Bess, because we were going to her home territory, Kentucky. Congressman Carl Perkins, whose district we would be covering, Bill Batt of the ARA, Howard Birch of the Farmers Home Administration, and Peter Jones of the Department of Commerce, who had prepared me by giving me Night Comes to the Cumberlands by Caudill to read, and some 34 press. Helen Thomas and Francis Lewin, whom I think of practically as twins, Marie Smith of the Post, Isabel Shelton of the Star, Eleanor Pollock of the Philadelphia Bulletin, and Nan Robertson, who wrote such good color stories in the New York Times about the ranch country, Gwen Gibson of the New York Herald Tribune and Mary Packenham of the Chicago Tribune, and Muriel Dobbins of the Baltimore Sun, Karen Kleinfelter, the best thing that's happened to the Dallas News in years, and Norma Ekdahl in her own home territory of the Lexington Herald, Norma Milligan of Newsweek, who's handling me very fairly, I think, Nancy Dickerson and her camera crew from NBC, and Bill Wise and Stan Wayman, who are doing a very understanding job on Lucy for life. We had coffee and sweet rolls aboard and arrived at Bluegrass Field, Lexington, about 8 o'clock, to be met by Governor and Mrs. Breathitt and their pretty children, Mayor and Mrs. Fred Fugazi, and Dr. and Mrs. John Oswald, President of the University of Kentucky. And about 150 people lined up along the fence, to whom, after I'd said hello to all the dignitaries, I went over and began shaking hands. Then began an 8-hour tour by motorcade, on foot, and in helicopter with my incongruous army of newspaper people and cameramen trailing behind me through the beautiful but economically depressed Cumberland Plateau. I love the picturesque names, Troublesome Creek, Lick Branch School, the community of Quicksand, Stray Branch. It was a country of hills and hollows, emerald green with spring, swift rocky streams crossed by footbridges, and occasionally a hillside blighted by strip mining, the process of simply scraping off the top of the earth with heavy machinery to get the coal and leaving it looking wounded and ugly with no reforestation. It's a beautiful country with a sad history of a declining economy that's gone on for the last 3 or 4 decades. Governor and Mrs. Breathitt were in the car with me, and as we rolled along the highway, we passed a school where all the students were lined up by the side of the road. It was the last day of school. Many of them were clutching report cards in their hands. Lots of them had an all-day sucker. I couldn't resist. I halted the whole motorcade, got out, shook hands with as many as I could reach, and then on we went to our first real stop, which was the home of Mr. and Mrs. Arthur Robertson and their 7 children at Washoe Branch. Marie Turner, superintendent of schools of Breathitt County, was at my side all day. And how lucky that community and area is to have her, because she loves her job and does the best she can with it. A lot of the good that has happened to many of the youngsters who have come out of there must be traced back to this woman. As we stopped, she said rather diffidently that it was almost a mile up the creek to the house where the Robertsons lived, and she thought they could make it in the school bus. She wasn't sure. I said, no, I'd lots rather walk. So I put on my black boots, which have walked many a mile around the ranch, and led my small army up the winding path along Washoe Branch to the 3-room house of the Arthur Robertsons. They were lined up on the front porch, Mr. and Ms. Robinson, 6 sons, and 1 little girl, Judy Ann, who scrubbed and dressed up for the occasion, offered me a bunch of wildflowers, red and yellow, snake tongue and rooster comb. I was delighted. Thin, wiry, gaunt-faced Arthur Robertson was easy to talk to and full of ginger, although he looked like he hadn't had a square meal enough of the days of his 36 years. We had come here because he had taken advantage of a $700 government grant, which paid for the materials only, to winterize their house, put asbestos siding and insulation in it, to dig a well, build a privy. All of the labor he did himself, and also because, through help and instruction from the Agriculture Department, he had cleared and put into tobacco about 3/5 of an acre of his unbelievably hilly little farm. I walked around with him for about 30 minutes and really enjoyed it. He showed me the log cabin they had lived in before he had built the house with his own hands that they now live. Three of their children were born in the log cabin. He now has a part-time job on the Unemployed Parents Program, setting out pine trees on Stray Branch, where he works for about 160 hours a month. Tobacco is his only cash crop, but he has a Poland China hog and kills about 2 pigs a year for his family's table, a few chickens, and he had the most marvelous-looking garden. Potatoes were coming along fine, which he said one of his sons had planned and did all the work on. To approach his house, I walked across a footbridge, really just a log, across Washoe Branch. And that is the picture that all the newspapers found the most typical of the day. The bet we are making, the government, and it is a large bet because the federal government is pouring about $200 million a year into Kentucky since 1961 to improve health, housing, for job retraining, for school lunch, public works, and similar public service programs, is that you can do this without destroying the character, the self-reliance of American citizens. When you look into the faces of the children, you see good raw material, and you know that that is the hope of the future for this area. Education, job training, and eventually some kind of opportunities for employment, some industry, some way of making a living beside the mortally ill coal industry in this beautiful part of the world. Inside the house, there was a framed marriage license, a picture of Jesus, some very family-type pictures, I believe a wedding picture. The children were all very clean and polite, but there certainly wasn't a fat one in the lot. At least they have, poor as they are, the beautiful forest and the streams to live with instead of asphalt and concrete buildings. One of the little boys, Lonnie, I believe he was, gave me his school picture. I still have it. This is being recorded several days later, and I can't help but quote a line from a letter from Mrs. Robertson. She talked about the visit, and then, in talking about their future, there was a line, "It don't hurt to dream." We trudged out of the holler over the footbridge. The dusty, sweating cameraman carrying packs that must have weighed, 50 or more pounds, up to the highway, and then on to Lick Branch School. One-room schoolhouse, very much like Fern School, where I went from the time I was 5 until I was 11. Except there are 25 children here, grades through 1 to 8. It's in a beautiful, leafy, wooded holler. And once more, you reach it by crossing a little bridge. Schoolhouse architecture hasn't changed any. Not only was the house the same, but there was a great big pot-bellied stove inside. Only this one burns coal, I'm sure. And I told the youngsters that in my childhood, the biggest boy always had the job of putting in first the kindling and then the big wood and lighting the stove the first thing when we got there on cold winter mornings. All the children were dressed up, the little girls, and lots of them were so pretty, in stiff, starched, pink dresses, everybody clean, really fine-looking young folks. Their Anglo-Saxon names, Bush, Bowling, Watts, Turner. Unlike Fern, one wall was covered with a map, and one of the children explained to me that every time anybody went on a vacation, as they sometimes did in the summer months, when they got back, they would draw a line to the town where they had gone, and they would tell their schoolmates all about it. And there were lots of bright colored pictures around, including pictures of the presidents. We had a hot lunch, which cost 10 cents, for all those who can afford to pay for it. If you can't, you get it free. It's part of the government's cash program to help hard-hit parts of Kentucky. It consisted of canned pork, green beans, hot cornbread cooked by a neighbor across the street, gingerbread for dessert, and milk. They bring in about 2 weeks' supply at a time. It's furnished by the government. Leave it at the neighbor's house, street's not the word, across the creek. And she heats it up for them and makes the cornbread herself several days a week just as a neighborly gesture. The only trouble about the meal is that you can't eat and talk at the same time. And I didn't get to eat much because I was so much more interested in talking and listening. The children put on a puppet show for me, all about the little small red hen. You know, the one that asked the duck and the pig several other farm animals to help her plant the corn and weed the corn and hoe the corn and pick the corn and finally to make the cornbread, and not a soul would help until she said, "Now who will help me eat the cornbread?" At which time, of course, everybody was ready to help. They had quite a collection of puppets, and I thought it delightful that two of them were Daniel Boone and Black Beauty. So speaks Kentucky. Before lunch, everybody had washed their hands, including me, at a very sensible device, a perforated zinc bucket full of water hanging from a nail. The water dripped through into a large garbage can below, and you washed your hands as it came out. We hadn't thought of that at Fern. The school desks were just the same, even the names cut with pocket knives by little boys. But I didn't see any little girl with plaits that the boys would have pulled the hair off or put them in the inkwell as they used to at Fern. After the puppet show, we went out on the front porch, and I presented the Lick Branch School with a flag, one that had flown over the capital of the United States. They had already provided a flagpole, and we ran up the flag while they all gave the Pledge of Allegiance. It was a moment to remember. I had also brought them a set of encyclopedias. But the biggest event of the day was that electric lights had been installed just prior to my getting there. All the fixtures had actually been presented as a gift by the Sylvania Electric Company, and I was the first person to throw the switch. They say on dark days in that hollow you can scarcely see, and school sometimes turns out at 2 o'clock on winter afternoons. So this is a big advance. Two of the mamas had made a quilt for me, the Dutch girl pattern. It will be very much at home at the ranch. And then I saw something that Fern School never had, a bookmobile. It comes round to all the little schools, at least all the ones that have roads that you can get to, and some of them don't have roads that you can get to. Very wonderful addition to rural life, but so much depends on the quality of books they carry around. I walked in and looked around, and great as the idea is, I wish they had reached a little higher in the mental food they had to offer these fine-faced youngsters. Finally, I said goodbye and rode away with Marie Turner, thinking about particularly two things she had told me, that when some of the youngsters first came to school in September, they were listless, dull, not very interested, and then after they had had a good meal for about 3 or 4 months, they would just pick up, show a lot of improvement in their schoolwork, get livelier, even get a little mischievous. She also said they gave them breakfast, a lot of them that they knew hadn't had much breakfast before they left home. Oatmeal and milk were about the staple breakfast. And the other thing that she said, when I asked her if they had much turnover in the school, she said, yes, a teacher hardly ever stays longer than 1 year in these little one-room schoolhouses. She has 26 such schoolhouses in her domain, which is Breathitt County. It's hard to attract young people to such, young, vital teachers. You must board with the neighbors where the facilities are often outdoor toilets and muddy roads that no prospective date can come over, and not much chance for getting out even on weekends, which made me hark back to Ken Galbraith's idea of an elite teachers' corps. Our next stop, still accompanied by Marie Turner, Trevor Howell, who is her daughter, was at the Breathitt High School in Jackson. A new gymnasium was to be dedicated. What interesting rhythm of the bell of history. This should be on the same site where an old gymnasium was dedicated by Mrs. Roosevelt 26 years ago. It was a clean, bright building, lots of glass, every seat full. I was introduced by an attractive, poised young girl, Trevor Louise Howell, Marie Turner's granddaughter, a senior in Breathitt County High School. She's carrying on in the tradition for the third generation. And then I made my first real little talk of the day to the 5,000 guests, including the Lieutenant Governor, Congressman Carl Perkins, Bill Batt, of course, Peter Jones, and my entourage of newspaper folks. Delightfully enough, there were three of the graduates there, Trevor Howell among them, who had been present when Mrs. Roosevelt had dedicated the gymnasium 26 years before. This gymnasium was built as one of the 188 accelerated public works programs in the Cumberland area, a partnership deal between local initiative and federal support. After the speech, Mrs. Breathitt, presented me with a beautiful hooked rug, an art still practiced by old people in the area, with a federal eagle in the middle, and a quilt that is a very aristocrat among quilts, tiniest little stitches. I wish these crafts could be brought to their fullest fruition, a combination of the most marketable quality and the most indigenous native art, and help the economy of the region. Next, we went to the Wood Utilization Center at Quicksand, which is sponsored by the University of Kentucky, and here, Dr. Oswald, president of the university. A combination of the Area Redevelopment Administration, which has actually built the center, and the assistance of the Kentucky Farm Bureau Federation and the U.S. Forest Service, a very joint effort to give young men skills in using this region's most valuable potential natural resource, its timber. The mountains are covered by oak, pine, beech, poplar, but when they go to build a new school or anything, they buy the finished product from another state. This center teaches them things beginning with logging and sawmill facilities, timber stand improvement, harvest cutting, surveying, mapping, timber estimating, fire prevention and suppression, things I don't even know the names of, how to get the timber out of the forest, it's called logging, by skidding, bucking, hauling, log grading, and then the use of all sort of machinery, including laminating machinery and dry kill machinery, lathes, saws, wood preservation. Actually, the young men, it turns out, are good machine operators who can look forward to being supervisory personnel in the woodworking industry. Maybe, hopefully, someday, to come back and bring their own little plants to this very region, because that is what the region needs. More little plants to bring jobs to the young people who otherwise go away seeking employment. I made a brief little talk here, and then left by helicopter from that delightful name, Quicksand, for a 30-minute ride over the beautiful green hills to Lexington. Then for a rest period, and on to dinner at the Kentucky Federation of Women's Clubs, which had brought to this beautiful town in the bluegrass women from all over Kentucky. Mrs. Adrian Doran, who could have sat for a portrait of the Southern Belle, presided and introduced me. She's one of those warm people, friendly, that you'd feel like you'd known a long time right after you met her. The Federation itself has many programs geared to the needs of the state. One for doctors' clinics, one called Operation Alphabet, to attack that statistic, 407,000 adult illiterates in Kentucky. But I had the feeling that the membership as a whole mostly belonged to the bluegrass section, for Kentucky is divided between some of the most lush and beautiful and wealthy country, and some of the most hilly and poor and backward country to be found in this union. And I think they were not too much in sympathy with my talk about the administration's war on poverty, and about the really very thrilling day I had spent in their home state, the need and the progress I had seen. Naturally, I took the occasion to talk about some of the beloved Kentuckians I had known, the Veep, the Fred Vinsons, Senator Ms. Errol Clements, and my own Bess Clements Abel. And also, this was a good springboard to recognize all the publicity about the two congressmen who had gone to see my tenants in Alabama with tape recorders in their briefcases. So I simply said, "Some people are suddenly very worried about the tenant families who live on my farm in Alabama. I'm glad they are concerned. I've been worried about these families a long time. And if there had been a poverty bill 30 years ago, those former cotton farmers would have been retrained to a new skill rather than remaining on in an economy that time has passed by. The lasting answer to wiping out poverty in this country is not just charity, but a full-scale program to provide job opportunity for all underprivileged families and educational opportunity for their children." This was a beautiful dressed-up evening with a lot of nice ladies, and I was charmed by Mrs. Doran. But the pictures that will linger in my mind are those of Lick Branch School and the hollow where the Robertsons lived.